This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Awakened Media, presenting The Real Dirt on Farmer John, a film about the true story of maverick farmer John Peterson's hero's journey of life, love, death, and sweet potatoes. Opens Wednesday, February 1st at Cinema 21. Information at therealdirt.net.
With our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KABU News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KABU's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KABU News.
KABU's Eduardo Villanderos Tiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KABU News.
I'm Michael Newman, KABU News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KABU News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, Portland Mayor Tom Potter has proposed an almost 1% income tax for city residents.
Congress will soon be expected to vote on expiring provisions of the USA Patriot Act.
Bolivian President Evo Morales ends his first week of government with two significant moves.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,239 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers, with as many as 48,000 others wounded. IraqBodyCount.org reports 31,800 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. Last year, the medical journal The Lancet reported as many as 194,000 civilian casualties, not counting Fallujah, since the invasion.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Friday, January 27th, 2006. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Annalisa Hummel. Portland Mayor Tom Potter has proposed an almost 1% income tax for city residents to help pay for local schools. The tax would last for 4 years and be augmented by a 1.4% business license surcharge. Potter says he doesn't consider it paying taxes, but instead, quote, investing in our children's future. The mayor said this yesterday at a rally at Benson High School. He adds the money would stay in the classroom and not be used for administrative costs. He plans to appoint a citizen oversight panel and conduct annual audits of the school districts. Potter's plan, if approved by the city council next month, would have to be ratified by voters in May.
The Portland Peaceful Response Coalition at this hour is holding its weekly Friday downtown gathering. This week, the coalition is sending a message to Senator Hillary Clinton, who's in Portland this weekend for a fundraiser. The message, bring our troops home now. KABU's Andy Seaton is at Pioneer Courthouse Square and is live on the phone with us. Andy.
Hey there. It's a beautiful late winter, early global warming spring day. The flowers are beginning to sprout down here. We've got a good turnout down at the Portland Peaceful Response Coalition March, regular Friday March. They've been doing this for over 4 years since the invasion of Afghanistan. And there's a special guest in town tonight, Hillary Clinton. And a longtime volunteer, Will Seaman, is here to talk about it.
Will, are you there?
I'm there, yes. There, along with several other groups, Code Pink, for example, Veterans for Peace, Americans United for Palestinian Human Rights, PPRC is going to be a part of a local greeting for Senator Hillary Clinton, who's in town to do, of all things, fundraising. And, of course, I think KABU listeners know, but certainly the peace movement knows, that Hillary Clinton, like John Kerry before her, upon deciding to aim for the White House, has been sprinting to the right. And we are out here, we're going to be out in front of the Executive Hilton when she gets here to say that the trend is in the other direction. The trend is against this war and occupation, and we're going to try to remind her to embrace once again some policies that have been traditional policies of the Democratic Party, and we'd like them to once again be a part of that party's platform.
She's coming to the downtown Clinton, or rather to the downtown Hilton there. When will she be coming in?
It's the Executive Hilton. We're going to be gathering out there probably sometime between 7 and 7:30. The festivities, which are going to involve also the rest of the Oregon Democratic delegation, Blumenauer, Cooley, DeFazio, Wu, all of them will be there. And that's at the Executive Hilton, and I think it's 921 Southwest 6th here in downtown Portland.
Uh-huh. And why are you targeting Hillary especially?
Well, we're targeting her as a something of an opportunity, but also we're quite appalled by the fact that this standard bearer for the Democratic Party, this person who is sort of the presumed candidate for the presidency in 2008, has been moving in the conservative direction, just like John Kerry before her in his disastrous run for the president. She has not taken a strong stand against this war, whereas that is precisely the direction of most of this country. She has taken an appalling stand on, for example, the apartheid wall in Israel and the occupied territories. She has come out in support of a wall that the International Court in the Hague found to be a breach of international law. These kind of policies are not what is going to get a Democrat into the White House. But more importantly, these kind of policies are just plain wrong. They're wrong principally. They're wrong ethically. We have to oppose them.
All right. Thank you very much, Will Seaman.
Thank you.
Down at the Portland, with the Portland Peaceful Response Coalition down at Pioneer Courthouse Square. And that was Andy Seaton with KBOO News.
This week, the town of Newport on the Oregon coast rejected a proposal for locating a ship-breaking operation in the middle of Yakina Bay. The State Economic Development Corporation, Baybridge Enterprises, and the Newport Commission had worked on the deal for months before it was presented to the citizens of Newport. People learned of the deal on Thanksgiving weekend 2005. 3 days later, they had formed Friends of Yakina Bay. Then they gathered nearly 400 signatures, published a full-page ad in a New Times paper, and launched a successful grassroots movement. They educated friends and neighbors through tireless outreach efforts. When the Port Commission met on Tuesday, January 25th, no one in the overflow crowd was prepared for their stunning victory. This is Port Commissioner Don Mann making the announcement.
We can only invest in infrastructure and bringing in new businesses at a level that are still a responsible return on the investment. In the case of Baybridge Enterprise, even though this company checked out as being a good, sound business and has proven to be a safe and environmentally friendly company, our continued work for developing the feasibility of this project has led Port staff to conclude that it does not seem to fit our test of good business. Good business management.
That was Newport's Port Commissioner Don Mann. Thanks to KBOO's Chris Andre for the report.
The income gap between rich Oregonians and both middle and low-income families continues to grow, according to a new study released Thursday. KBOO's Kirk Vanderveer reports.
Good news for the rich in Oregon. They're getting richer. A new study released Thursday from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities and the Economic Policy Institute shows the gap between those with the most and those with the least is getting wider. Michael Leachman with the Oregon Center for Public Policy says that has an impact for Oregon's economy as a whole.
A very small number of Oregon households have done wildly well over the last generation. If the benefits of growth had been more broadly shared, the state's longer-term economic health would be better protected.
Leachman says the federal government could help close the gap by repealing recent tax cuts for the rich. He says the state could help, too.
Expanding the state's earned income credit for working low-income families and phasing out the personal exemption credit for higher-income families.
Leachman says in the previous generation after World War II, families of all incomes saw relatively equal income gains. Content was provided by the Oregon News Service. I'm Kirk Vanderveer, KBOO News.
The U.S. Board on Geographic Names has approved 16 name changes for Oregon geographic features with the name Squaw. Many Indians in Oregon and elsewhere consider the term Squaw an insult. The approval assigns new names to 5 creeks, 4 butters, 4 canyons, 2 meadows, and 2 waterfalls in central Oregon. At least 125 other spots exist with the name Squaw, which is more than any other state. The decision follows a move by the legislature to rename all such places.
St- Stay tuned for Counterspin following our newscast. At 5:55, it's Independent Native News. Then at 6 o'clock, hear Bread and Roses. At 7, Jay's Place with J.J. Johnson. Tonight's weather, rainy and breezy with lows 35 to 40. And tomorrow, rain with highs around 50. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
Liberal groups are capitalizing on the F-word, filibuster. They're coming out in unison and urging Democrats to follow Senator John Kerry's lead and block the confirmation of Supreme Court nominee Samuel Alito. But as FSRN's Lee Ann Caldwell report from Capitol Hill, some Democrats won't go down that road.
Confirmation of Judge Samuel Alito Jr. is expected, but progressive groups are shouting loudly for a filibuster. Elliot Minsberg is vice president and legal director for People for the American Way.
It's reproductive rights. It's cutting down on Congress's authority. There's a case this year that he could be the deciding vote on that could strip the Clean Water Act of its protection over 90% or more of a lot of our nation's waterways. There's civil rights. There's trying to restrain executive power. On all of these issues, Alito has staked out positions that are extremely dangerous.
But the widespread call for a filibuster, the move to block a vote, didn't begin until yesterday, 2 days into the confirmation debate on the Senate floor. Again, Minsberg.
Frankly, it had been our hope that it might be possible to get enough people to vote him down to prevent him from getting on the Supreme Court. But from our perspective, filibuster has always been on the table and never off the table.
People for the American Way have been one of the first groups to come out. You've been done extensive research on Alito, but I never really did see the word filibuster.
Because our view was, we felt it was critical that Alito be stopped from being on the Supreme Court by all appropriate means. What exactly the right way to do that is depends on the circumstances.
Many groups were calling for any means necessary to stop Judge Alito, but the apparent catalyst to filibuster began yesterday when the New York Times published an editorial titled Senators in Need of a Spine, which was referring to Democrats' position on President Bush's conservative nominee, Judge Alito. Later in the day, Democratic Senator John Kerry from Massachusetts, presidential candidate in 2004 and likely candidate in 2008, called for the vote-blocking move.
This impact is going to be now. This choice is now. And this ideological direction is defined now.
He was backed immediately by fellow Massachusetts Democrat Edward Kennedy and Democratic Whip Richard Durbin from Illinois. A large number of opposition votes were expected against Alito, but Democrats have not come out in unilateral support for the filibuster. At airtime, roughly two dozen Democrats support the move, leaving about 20 who are either undecided or have come out against it.
I have concluded I cannot justify a filibuster in this case.
Democrat Kent Conrad from North Dakota made his announcement this morning after a meeting with Alito. He cited overwhelming support by the American Bar Association as one of his deciding factors. Republicans are confident that the filibuster attempt will fail, and Democratic leadership also believes Alito will be confirmed. Republican Senator Jeff Sessions from Alabama spoke on the Senate floor about Senator Kerry in Davos, Switzerland at the World Economic Forum, where he made the announcement for a filibuster.
Maybe they ought to spend more time trying to get the oil prices, gasoline prices down than worrying about conjuring up a filibuster of a judge as able as Judge Alito.
Four Democrats have joined all 55 Republicans in blocking the filibuster, which means that coalition only needs one more. That vote will take place Monday night. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Congress is expected to vote soon on expiring provisions of the USA Patriot Act. But as FSRN's Mark Taylor Canfield reports from Seattle, legislators may not be fully aware of all the provisions.
According to the American Civil Liberties Union, a proposed change to the USA Patriot Act would allow the federal government to designate restricted zones at any events considered to be of national significance. The ACLU's Council for National Security Policy, Tim Edgars, says the provision was slipped into the reauthorization bill at the request of the Secret Service, without the knowledge of most members of Congress or the media.
The problem here is that Congress is considering, without any debate, without having considered it in either the House or the Senate, a major expansion of the Secret Service's ability to impose these exclusion zones that have been used to harass clearly legitimate protesters.
Exclusion zones became a controversial issue in the U.S. during the 1999 World Trade Organization Ministerial Conference in Seattle, when authorities established a large no-protest zone near the conference site. This move resulted in a major class-action lawsuit for violations of the First Amendment. The ACLU is concerned that the new measure would fully legalize restrictions on the constitutionally protected activity of peaceful assembly and the exercise of free speech. Congress is expected to vote on the reauthorization of the Patriot Act by February 2nd. This is Mark Taylor Canfield reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Seattle.
The investigation of Jack Abramoff, disgraced Republican lobbyist, took a surprising new turn on Thursday when the Justice Department said the chief prosecutor in the inquiry will step down next week because he had been nominated to a federal judgeship by George W. Bush. The prosecutor, Noel Hillman, is chief of the department's Public Integrity Division, and the move ends his involvement in an inquiry that has reached into the administration as well as the top ranks of the Republican leadership on Capitol Hill. The administration said that the appointment was routine and that it would not affect the investigation. Democrats, however, swiftly questioned the timing of the move and called for a special prosecutor. Mr. Hillman's departure from the Justice Department creates a vacancy at the top of the Abramoff inquiry only 3 weeks after Mr. Abramoff, once one of the city's most powerful Republican lobbyists and a major fundraiser for Mr. Bush, announced his guilty plea.
It's 5:18, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Do you fear that the American people have become as fat, lazy, and submissive as a bunch of cud-chewing cows? That we can be led anywhere the powers that be choose to take us? Well, if you think that we the people have totally lost our rebellious spark, let me tell you a heartening cow story. Few creatures in the animal kingdom are perceived to be as doltish and docile as your average bovine, which seems content to spend its short life standing in a field mooing, eating, and pooping before being led to slaughter. So imagine the surprise of people in Southern California to learn that a herd of 9 wily, wiry, and wild cows are loose in the canyons and brush of the Santa Monica Mountains. These are renegade cows that escaped from a rancher's pen 5 years ago and bolted into the neighboring National Recreation Area in the mountains. Even though you'd think it would be easy to track down a herd of 1,000-pound brown, black, and white cattle in a frequently used park just across Interstate 405 from Beverly Hills, these rebels have rarely been seen, much less rounded up. How could such lumbering sirloins-to-be avoid detection? Well, animal scientists say that even slow-moving, slow-witted farm animals never really lose their wild side, and those that escape can switch on their natural survival instincts. One park ranger who has seen some of the wild Santa Monica Nine say that they are elusive, cunning, and surprisingly fleet of foot. I came close to them, he says, and they just took off running like a deer might if you were to get too close. If these feral rebels are captured, however, they will dull down again, fatten up on what they're fed, and resign themselves to the fate of the meat market. This is Jim Hightower saying, the lesson here is that we all have the seed of insurgency within us, ready to break loose from the confines of the corporate order and live life on our own terms. So, rise up, America, and turn loose your wild side. Today's commentary is made possible in part by the good folks at Mother Jones Magazine. Over the years, Mother Jones has won just about every award available while ticking off the honchos of business and government. They're proud of both distinctions. Find out more at motherjones.com.
Bolivian President Evo Morales ends his first week of government with two significant moves. FSRN's Diletta Farlis reports from Santa Cruz, Bolivia.
Soon after his inauguration, President Evo Morales appointed several well-known activists to cabinet-level positions. The new Minister of Water, Abel Mamani, is the former leader of an neighborhood organization that expelled a French multinational corporation from the impoverished city of El Alto for failure to deliver water services. Hydrocarbons Minister Andrés Solís Rada is a lawyer and a journalist who has spent 30 years defending Bolivia's natural resources. President Morales ended his first week in office by reducing his salary by 50%. He will now earn slightly less than $1,900 a month. The pay cut will affect most high-ranking office holders, as no government employee in Bolivia is allowed to make more than the president. The new step for the new administration will be to start the discussion on reforms to the country's hydrocarbons law. For First Petroleo News, Diletta Varlese from Santa Cruz, Bolivia.
Hundreds of Fatah supporters took to the streets of Gaza City today, protesting their party's loss in the historic legislative elections and calling for the resignation of the Fatah leadership. In Gaza City, FSRN's Leila Al-Haddad has the story.
The mob of young supporters, which included the militant wing of Fatah al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades, marched throughout the city streets, shooting wildly into the air and blaming the Fatah leadership for the crushing blow in the elections. In front of his Gaza residence, they gave Mahmoud Abbas 3 days to resign, accusing him of being an Israeli agent. They then swarmed the Legislative Council, burning government vans, scaling the walls of buildings, and yanking out air conditioners and wires from its exterior. Mohamed Dahlan, one of the few Fatah leaders to win a seat in the district of Khan Yunis, and a very popular Fatah leader among supporters, came out to calm down the angry mob. He assured them Fatah would always be the first Palestinian revolutionary movement, despite other groups' attempts to conspire against it, before being whisked away by his bodyguards. For Free Speech Radio News in Gaza, this is Leila Al-Haddad.
The world powers that make up the Middle East Quartet say they will not deal with the newly elected Palestinian government, Hamas, unless it rejects its call to destroy Israel. The quartet, made up of the UN, the EU, Russia and the US, issued a statement calling on Hamas to renounce violence and accept Israel's right to exist. The Islamic militant group gained a sweeping victory in Thursday's parliamentary polls. International mediators have urged the Islamic militant group to renounce violence as efforts begin to form a new government.
The United Nations is preparing to intervene in the Darfur crisis in Sudan after admitting that an African Union mission has failed to control the violence. 7,000 AU troops are currently in the region, but the mission is underfunded. Ongoing rebel attacks have prompted aid agencies to pull out of some areas. Around 100 aid workers have left the West Darfur town of Golo after a Sudanese aid worker was killed by a helicopter crash Wednesday. At least 2 million people have fled fighting in Darfur since 2003, and at least 180,000 have died in the conflict.
That's the KBOO Evening News for Friday, January 27th, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203 or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis, at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kwoo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Kirk Vanderveer. Tonight's audio editor is Noah Eaton. Special thanks to reporters Chris Andre, Andy Seaton, and Kirk Vanderveer. Our engineer is D.R. Garrett. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta. Coming up Monday morning on KBOO at 7:30, Cecil and Celeste host More Talk Radio. Their guest is Christian Weller, senior economist at the Center for American Progress. The topic is pensions for U.S. workers. What's the future? And at 9, it's the Old Mole Variety Hour with interviews, commentary, and analysis of current issues. At 10, Dr. David Naiman hosts Health Watch. At 10:30 on Earthwatch, Chris Andre hosts a program on the issue of shipwrecking on the Oregon coast. This is part two of the series she began last week. And at 11, Democracy Now! That's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-owned community radio station. Lao Tzu said, "Knowing ignorance is strength. Ignoring knowledge is sickness."
Good night, Liam.
Good night, Annalisa.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and by the Portland Alliance, the city's oldest alternative progressive newspaper, reporting on issues ignored or distorted by corporate-dominated media and providing a voice for social justice activists, environmentalists, trade unionists, and the progressive community. Information at 503-239-4991 or theportlandalliance.org.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, New Orleans is back in the news. Along with the debates about how the city should be rebuilt, the White House is accused of stonewalling a congressional Katrina investigation. And the administration is offering Louisiana a fraction of the dollars the state says it needs for a homeowner bailout. What many of these stories have in common, says our guest, Jordan Flaherty of Left Turn Magazine, is the exclusion of the people who will be most affected by the policies. Also on the show, the corrupt Capitol Hill favor trading operation known as the K Street Project has been operating for years now and was no secret to the mainstream press corps. So why did most of the public only learn about it with the recent guilty plea of lobbyist Jack Abramoff? We'll hear from Rolling Stone contributing editor Eric Bollert on what he calls a media boycott of this critically important story. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at recent press.
ABC's John Stossel has a habit of editing selectively, twisting the truth, and leaving out facts that would undermine his pay-ins to the so-called free market. On January 13th, Stossel offered up a prime example of his unethical style of journalism in an hour-long 2020 report on the school choice controversy. In the report, Stossel promoted charter schools and voucher programs as the solution to American public education ills. Because they promote competition between schools, Stossel's argument went, these programs increase academic achievement. But as the website Media Matters pointed out, Stossel's report failed to provide even a semblance of balance. Stossel featured 8 interviews with voucher or charter school advocates, totaling about 1,400 words, but gave only 360 words to the 2 opponents interviewed. For example, Stossel turned to Jay Green, a senior fellow at the conservative Manhattan Institute, who gave spending figures to argue that public school funding is not the problem. But the second opinion on the point was not a critic, of which there are many, but a private school principal who seconded Green's argument. Stossel also interviewed one economist, Caroline Hawksby, who claimed that Milwaukee's voucher program greatly increased test scores at both public and private schools. But again, Stossel left out the other side of the story, not informing viewers that many other economists have disputed Hawksby's findings. And when Stossel claimed that, quote, many charter schools are succeeding, close quote, viewers might have liked to know that a federal study found charter schools have lower reading scores than regular public schools. But apparently Stossel's quest to even the playing field in the education market doesn't extend to the market of ideas.
The popular search engine Google has agreed to abide by censorship rules in order to operate in China, a country with extremely restrictive controls over information, but evidently more importantly for the company, the second largest internet market in the world. At China's behest, Google launched an altered version of their search engine that will block users from searching such politically sensitive terms as human rights and democracy. Falun Gong, forget it. Distressing on its face, the move represents another giant step away from the Internet's promise as a purveyor of a truly free press. Just last year, Yahoo came under attack for collaborating with Chinese authorities to arrest a journalist who had emailed alleged state secrets to pro-democracy organizations in the U.S. Google's solution to avoiding those kinds of problems is simply to withhold email and blogging capacity. Listeners may know that Google refused to go along with the U.S. Department of Justice's efforts to eavesdrop on Internet use in what it calls an effort to fight online child pornography. The company emerged from that fight looking like principled defenders of privacy. The China decision suggests that that decision, too, may have been reached not so much in accordance with Google's much-cited motto, "Don't be evil," as with a more mundane assessment of financial risks and benefits.
The White House claims George Bush doesn't know Jack Abramoff, the lobbyist who pled out to bribery and fraud convictions in the Washington scandal that threatens to bring down members of Congress. On January 22nd, Newsweek reported that there were several pictures of Abramoff meeting with George Bush at the White House. But the administration has dummied up about the details of Abramoff's White House visits, with spokesperson Scott McClellan refusing to tell reporters anything more than that Abramoff met with White House staff. Was the president thanking the felonious lobbyist who collected more money for Bush in 2004 than for any other politician? We don't know, but it sounds like a big, fat, intriguing story. The more for it because of the White House's suspicious behavior. So far, though, Bush's Abramoff connections, the pictures and the meetings haven't created much of a media stir. Writing about the relative media silence in the January 30th New York Observer, columnist Joe Connison reminded us of an earlier episode involving White House photos. Quote, 8 years ago, the Clinton White House released photos and videos of President Clinton's coffee meetings with campaign donors and potential donors following angry demands from politicians and the press. How fortunate for Mr. Bush that his scandals and prevarications provoked no such outrage. Close quote.
Watching television is frequently discomforting, but few things are uncomfortable in quite the same way as watching a mainstream TV host interview a black person. Black guests often seem to get a line of questioning that white people rarely do, particularly black leaders who are time and time again called upon to represent the entire black community or to answer for some other particular black person, as if African Americans were basically interchangeable or at the very least all know one another. The latest example was the January 22nd Meet the Press, in which host Tim Russert persisted in grilling Illinois Senator Barack Obama about comments critical of George Bush, comments made by Harry Belafonte. Surely at least some viewers were confused as to why Obama should have to answer for statements made by Belafonte with no evident connection between the two men except, well, you know. Among several critics to wonder at the exchange was Vanity Fair contributing editor James Walcott, whose blog posting that day offered a few more questions he'd rather expected Russert to include in his Obama interview, such as, what's your favorite UPN show? And Bobby Brown, Whitney Houston, A Marriage in Turmoil. Any thoughts? Sometimes all you can do is laugh.
Finally, commenting on a new Osama bin Laden video in which the Al-Qaeda leader talks about the war merchants in Washington, MSNBC Hardball host Chris Matthews compared bin Laden to American film director Michael Moore on his January 19th show. Quote, this is from earlier today. I mean, he sounds like an over-the-top Michael Moore here, if not a Michael Moore, close quote. Perhaps Matthew's shrill comments would make some sort of sense if he applied them with a single standard to figures across the ideological spectrum. But you won't hear Matthews, for instance, commenting that Taliban cleric Mullah Omar sounds like a George W. Bush. Not if his January 23rd show is any indication. On that show, Matthews fawned over Tom DeLay, the indicted Republican House whip, with this puffball question. Quote, look, I've got to ask you a question. Tom DeLay, you're not in this business for the money. You live modestly. You commute back and forth from Washington to Houston, Texas. Why? What drives you every day? Close quote. DeLay's response, quote, what I believe in and the Constitution of the United States. Ronald Reagan got me involved in this. I fight every day for what I believe in. Close quote. Almost brings a tear to the eye. The double standard is one thing, but Matthew's description of DeLay's lifestyle is laughable. As the website thinkprogress.org pointed out, in the past 6 years, Delay has enjoyed at least 48 visits to golf clubs and resorts, 100 flights aboard company planes, 200 stays at hotels, many world-class, and 500 meals at restaurants, some averaging nearly $200 for a dinner for two.
Thanks, Steve. You're listening to Counterspin. Counterspin is brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair.
The media focus on New Orleans may have faded somewhat, but some recent newsworthy stories have gained significant coverage. For instance, leaked documents show the White House had advance warning that Katrina would, quote, likely lead to severe flooding and or levee breaching, close quote. That's in contrast to George Bush's September 1st claim that nobody anticipated the breach of the levees. On January 25th, a bipartisan congressional group said the White House was stonewalling their investigation into the catastrophe. The same day, the administration rejected Louisiana's $30 billion homeowner bailout plan, offering one-fifth of the requested amount, and arguing that only homeowners without insurance who live outside the floodplain should qualify. As Keith Olbermann put it on his January 24th MSNBC show Countdown, quote, that means most everyone who is either poor, black, lived on low ground, or in the city of New Orleans need not bother applying, close quote. Joining us now is Jordan Flaherty of Left Turn Magazine. He's been covering New Orleans for the past 5 months from the angle of the least powerful and from the point of view of neighborhood activists. Jordan Flaherty, thanks for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, Jordan, back in September when HUD Secretary Alfonso Jackson said that New Orleans, after rebuilding, won't be as black as it was, there was little elite outrage. Yet, when New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin recently remarked that New Orleans should remain a black-majority city, a chocolate city, as he put it, the outrage broke through to the national television level. What do those very different reactions signify to you?
It's a clear example of the discrimination we're seeing and the different views of race as how it affects New Orleans. Jackson is somebody that actually, as a federal official, as the head of HUD, has really a lot more control than Nagin over whether or not the city will be majority black or majority white. So in him saying that, he's expressing much more something that could become reality. Mayor Nagin, I believe, was pandering to some constituencies of the city. He is actually a candidate who was elected with 80% of the white vote and less than 40% of the black vote of the city of New Orleans. He received 85% of the vote in some districts in the mostly white Lakeview neighborhood. He has always been seen as the candidate of developers, the candidate of business people, and the candidate of the white community of New Orleans. And what's wrong with Mayor Nagin talking about New Orleans being a chocolate city again is not the idea of New Orleans being a majority black city again. What's really wrong is that he's lying. He does not represent the black folks of New Orleans. And New Orleans is a city with a rich cultural history. It's not enough just to say that it's 70% black, or was 70% black before the hurricane came. It's a population that has long, long roots to the city, more than almost any other city in the country. And for those people to be dispersed and not allowed to come back, it's a real form of cultural erasure. And it's very sad and very painful for those of us that love the city to see that culture destroyed by people being brought away. And there's a real concern among people from New Orleans that it won't be a majority black city again.
Well, what is the plan that's being consensed around by the elites and by the developers right now?
Well, you keep hearing these consultants and experts who are not identified saying that in 3 years, this city that used to have a population of nearly 500,000 will have a population of only 275,000. And they don't say where that figure comes from, but to me that is a clear case of predicting by making it happen. It's circular logic. It's basically wish fulfillment.
That's what they want it to be.
Right.
That brings us to, there's practically a consensus view among elites and the media that lower-lying neighborhoods, those that tend to be mainly the poorer neighborhoods, should not be rebuilt for fear of future flooding. The dissenting arguments aren't often heard on this issue. Tell us what you're hearing in the communities that you cover.
there are so many places in this country and this world that are not viable. You have Florida that's always being hit by hurricanes. You have Las Vegas as a city in the built in a desert. You have cities built on fault lines. You have so many reasons that cities in this country are not viable. And to just choose New Orleans as being not viable, to me, seems like clearly, and to a lot of people from New Orleans, seems like clearly racism.
Jordan Flaherty, you obviously approach coverage of New Orleans a little differently than most mainstream journalists. Tell us about what you see as the shortcoming of the conventional media coverage of this story.
I've been traveling around the country a little bit, and people are always asking me when I say that I'm from New Orleans, is everything rebuilt yet? And the reason people are asking that is because the media is not telling them that, no, it's not rebuilt yet. In my neighborhood, and I'm fairly privileged, I live in a neighborhood that's come a lot farther than a lot of neighborhoods, but we still don't have mail. I still haven't gotten my mail from last August. We still don't have garbage collection. Much of the city is just still wreckage, is still destroyed, and that is not being conveyed in the media. The media has allowed people to think that everything is okay and everything is being done all right, and that the people of New Orleans may or may not want to come back. The fact that people want to come back and are being prevented from coming back, and that's what this policy really is doing, is preventing people from coming back. That's not being talked about in the media. The fact that real estate developers and corporate developers are running the plans for reconstruction and are deliberately planning to have a city with what they call a smaller footprint because it will serve their interests.
We're running out of time, but imagine yourself a network television executive, the head of a news division. What story would you direct your reporters to cover?
I believe it's the story of the grassroots resistance of people against all these odds that are coming back and that are rebuilding. People are rebuilding in the lower Ninth Ward, organizations like the People's Hurricane Relief Fund and Common Ground Collective and ACORN are rebuilding and helping people to come back and save these districts. You know, you have this undefined term, viable, that's used by the Mayor's Commission, that if people try and rebuild but it's not viable, they won't be allowed to. But people are still trying to rebuild and still trying to bring back this community and this culture, and that's inspiring to me, and that's what really needs the support of people around the world and the coverage of the mainstream media.
We've been speaking with Jordan Flaherty of Left Turn magazine. You can read his work on the website leftturn.org. Jordan Flaherty, thanks for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you. It's an honor.
When Jack Abramoff pled guilty in early January to conspiring to corrupt public officials, among other things, the major media seemed to enter a now-it-can-be-told phase, reporting on a deep-going network of bribery and corruption that surely left many in the public wondering, why hadn't I heard anything about this before? And why hadn't they? Was the so-called K Street Project, of which Abramoff's story is just one piece, a secret? Joining us now by telephone from New Jersey to shed a little light on why so little light has been shed on this critical story is Rolling Stone contributing editor Eric Bollert. Welcome back to Counterspin, Eric Bollert.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you say that the K Street Project is hands down the most important behind-the-scenes development in terms of how power legislation was bought and sold inside the Beltway. I know you can't give chapter and verse, but could you outline briefly what the K Street Project is? What should regular folk take away about its significance?
It started after the Gingrich Revolution in the 90s, but the K Street Project was sort of formally born around 2001, 2002. And the idea was for Republican leaders in Congress to really lay down the law. K Street is sort of the nickname in Washington where all the high-profile lobbyists reside. That's where their offices are. And so what Tom DeLay and Rick Santorum and Abramoff and Grover Norquist, who's an anti-tax activist in Washington, what they did, they sort of came up with this idea, which was to lay down the law in terms of lobbyists. Lobbyists were not going to have access to Republican leaders unless, A, they were registered Republicans, and, B, they gave a ton of money to Republican candidates. And so what the K Street Project was almost this dossier that Republicans kept on all the lobbyists, the thousands of lobbyists that pour through Capitol Hill, to make sure that they were basically playing for the right team and that they were giving the right team enough money. And again, in terms of Tom DeLay, I mean, he was very clear when the project was hatched, that if organizations, trade organizations or major corporations, if they didn't have Republican lobbyists and those lobbyists were not giving lots of money to Republicans, that those organizations were going to have trouble getting their stories heard on Capitol Hill and getting face time with congressmen. The Senate Ethics Committee looked at it and sent a letter to members saying this was a bad idea, and Republicans just dismissed it out of hand. But what it did, again, in terms of buying and selling power and legislation, it just completely altered the balance of power in Washington, sort of behind the scenes in the legislative process.
So that's why it was called a pay-for-play kind of scheme. You needed
exactly.
to be a donor in order to even get yourself heard. You might also say it further increased the clout of those who have lobbyists over those who don't have lobbyists at all.
Oh, right. Well, I mean, the days when you didn't have a lobbyist in Washington, those were sort of dwindling anyway. But this only sped up that process. And you're right, the pay-for-play, which was, you know, if you want to get FaceTime, you not only have to have the right connections, but you have to start writing checks specifically to Republican members of Congress.
Well, when we suddenly got a spate of stories at the time of Abramoff's plea, probably many people thought, this sounds sort of big for me not to have heard anything about it. But no doubt that's because I haven't been keeping up on my reading. So I wonder if you could give us a sense of just the numbers that you found in terms of the amount of coverage given to the K Street Project in the last few years. When you talk about a cone of silence, you're really not kidding.
Yeah, it was interesting because right after the plea agreements, I started, you know, the Washington Post had a story about the K Street Project, and the New York Times sort of had a story about the K Street Project, and they wrote about what Abramoff and DeLay and the others had done, and they did it in really, I thought, very graphic and aggressive terms, and just describing what was essentially this incredibly corrupt system. And I thought, gosh, I read the papers almost every day. Why now? So I went back, and the K Street Project was really given its name in June of 2002. And it's important to keep in mind, Republicans were not shy about this. They thought it was a brilliant scheme, and they boasted about it, practically held press conferences about it. This was not something that had to be investigated. Everyone in Washington knew what the K Street Project was in terms of every serious reporter in Washington. And everyone, I think, could in real time understand the deep ramifications. So what had been written or broadcast about the K Street Project between 2002 and January 2006, and the answer is virtually nothing. CBS News, no mention. NBC News, I think it was one mention. ABC News, one mention. CNN had five. Fox, zero. MSNBC, one. If you take 2.5 years of cable and network programming, news programming, and we're talking about literally tens of thousands of hours, and I think I found a combined 10 mentions on the K Street Project. Same with print. New York Times had done four stories which even mentioned it. All of them were just in passing reference. So I went to look at how many stories they did that had at least three references to K Street, which would indicate it's a little more detailed.
Mm-hmm.
New York Times had none. LA Times had none. Associated Press had none. Los Angeles Times had none. USA Today had none. Washington Post had two or three. So it was just this bizarre elephant in the middle of the room, and everyone just sort of acknowledging it and just looking the other way. And this is, of course, the same press corps, you know, which couldn't stop writing about the Lincoln bedroom sleepovers during the Clinton administration and couldn't stop writing about Al Gore's alleged fundraising problem.
You know, sometimes you get a feeling that a story is so far-reaching and so negative that journalists may feel like, if we run this, it's going to look like we're gunning for the White House. Is that what you mean by being afraid of the facts? Aren't facts simply facts, no matter who they hurt?
Well, it's hard to understand because, again, even if the Times or CNN doesn't do these in-depth investigations into the K Street, I mean, to literally just do a who, what, where, when, and why, what a simple journalism 101, what is the K Street Project, which has revolutionized the way lobbying and done in Washington. I mean, they didn't even do that. I just think it's this mindset of timidity which is set in, which is sort of this unspoken rule about what you do and do not cover. And basically, I mean, if the premise is reflecting poorly on Republicans and negatively on Republicans, and particularly if you're raising issues of corruption and ethical misdoings, that everyone just sort of nods and looks the other way. And again, during the Democratic years, I mean, the same press corps couldn't stop writing almost the exact same stories.
You cite Newsweek's Evan Thomas referring to, quote, this thing called the K Street Project, close quote, as if someone had just now told him about it. I wonder what that's about. Is there a desire here to kind of avoid saying, now that the story is out, is there a desire to avoid saying, oh, yes, we've known about this all along? You know, certainly it's the sort of thing that makes more and more people feel that big media are kind of just another group of insiders and not monitors at all.
Yeah, I mean, Evan Thomas's reference was typical. I think, I don't know if it's conscious, but it certainly seems that it would be awkward for these people either, A, to go on TV and start explaining what the K Street Project is, seeing how this is 3 years old. But on the other hand, I think to some degree you're right. They don't want to create too much attention because I think the obvious question is going to be, where were you for the last 32 months? Again, it doesn't have to be the cover of Newsweek, but how about a 600-word story that simply explains what's going on? I mean, that's what the D.C. Bureau is supposed to do on a regular basis.
Well, here's another media angle. People don't get stories like this. It's over their heads. Apparently that came from ABC's Jake Tapper, the idea that just the average people are confused by this kind of story. What is that line, and what's your response to it?
His larger argument was Democrats have not been able to score political points on this because he used as an example a couple of quotes from congressional leaders who mentioned the K Street Project, and he was sort of mocking them, saying, I mean, the irony was so thick. He was basically saying Americans don't understand what the K Street Project is, which is true, although the unspoken part was if ABC had, you know, taken the time to report what the K Street Project was, they might understand. And B, he was comparing it, you know, to the Contract America, which he thought resonated much more in terms of a political game plan. And, you know, he might be right. Maybe the K Street Project is too cerebral. But it would be nice if everyone was on the same page and Americans understood what the K Street Project was. And B, this idea that, you know, it's just too complicated and therefore, you know, the press doesn't want to go down a difficult alley and you know, you're talking about money and corruption and things like that. Something to be said for that. Then again, after 7 years of Whitewater coverage, I'm still not sure exactly where all that money was supposed to have gone. I mean, you know, the press spent years documenting what I thought was a labyrinth of nonsense. So they have no fear, it seems, during the Democratic administration to doing painstaking investigation and trying to follow the money trail. And yet the K Street Project was sort of this open secret and not that difficult to document, and everyone just sort of looked the other way.
And then forgetting partisanship, if the press isn't into stories about the influence of money on politics, why don't they just close up shop?
Yeah, again, the D.C. Bureau, yes, you're there to monitor what goes on in Congress and cover the hearings and get the quotes, but at some point, particularly, again, like the Washington Post, which really is almost designed specifically to monitor in detail the government culture in Washington and how things get done. I mean, even for them to essentially, for the last 3 years, do very little on the K Street Project and what the implications and what the serious questions were about it, waiting only until, you know, the plea agreement was announced to start sprinkling in some references seems really bizarre.
We've been speaking with Eric Bollert. His new book, Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush, is due out in May of this year. Thanks for joining us today on Counterspin, Eric Bollert.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. For more information about FAIR, you can check out our website. It's www.fair.org. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media. With me is Steve Rendell. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
On Friday, February 3rd at 6 p.m., tune in for Bread and Roses. Host Denise Kovalchuk will talk to Planned Parenthood for an update on pro-choice issues, to local nonprofit bookstore, in other words, about some great books on motherhood and feminism, and to a board member from Insight's Teen Parent Program who will talk about teen motherhood. That's on Friday, February 3rd from 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. right here on your community radio station, KBOO. We'll be right back.
Independent Native News for Friday, the 27th of January, 2006. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. Alaska Senator Ted Stevens says a new requirement for a passport to cross back over the Canadian border is creating confusion for Alaskans.
And I've had emergency calls, you know, how do I get a passport overnight?
Wednesday, he urged the U.S. Homeland Security Department to offer up more alternatives for people who often cross the border to get in and out of the state, especially in light of the fact that Alaska does not have a passport office in state.
If we're going to have a requirement for passports for land travel, you know, the passport office is going to be overwhelmed by Alaskans and people from the Northwest states that travel back and forth to our state. We have people in our state also that have to go through Canada to get home, and Canadians that have to come through our country to get home.
The passport requirement will phase in by the end of this year for air and water travel, and by the end of next year for land crossings. Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff recently announced that alternative documentation is being developed, such as a secure ID card that frequent travelers can use instead of a regular passport. But Stephen says the department should go beyond that to be fair to Alaskans.
This idea of having to go and get a special card for those people, you're basically talking about the rest of Americans. They don't even think about this the way we have to.
The situation is especially dire for rural residents, and many Alaska Natives have families that are split on both sides of the border. Stevens stressed that Homeland Security should acknowledge Alaska's unique situation, since it is the only state whose residents must cross a foreign country in order to access the contiguous United States. Meanwhile, Alaska Republican House Representative Don Young has been linked to former Washington lobbyist Jack Abramoff. A report in Wednesday's edition of the Washington, D.C. newspaper Roll Call claims Young helped Abramoff's tribal clients. Emily Meehan has details.
Roll Call cites a letter that Young, who's chairman of the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, and another committee member wrote on behalf of Native tribes seeking to develop the old post office pavilion in Washington, D.C. In the letter, Young urged the agency in charge of the site to give preferential treatment to tribes when considering development proposals. The old post office falls in a zone that is officially reserved for development by groups that are economically disadvantaged, including Native Americans. The newspaper reports that Young's Political Action Committee received $7,000 from two of Abramoff's tribal clients a month and a half after he wrote the letter. Roll Call also says while Young was previously chairman of the House Resources Committee, he supported a statehood plebiscite for Puerto Rico and certain policies of the Commonwealth of the Northern Marianas Islands at the same time Abramoff was lobbying for the same things. Mike Anderson, chief of staff in Young's personal office, maintains that Young can't recall ever meeting Abramoff and that there was no quid pro quo between Young's actions and contributions from Abramoff's clients. He told Roll Call that any overlap is mere circumstance because Young is actively involved in issues that Abramoff lobbied on. For Independent Native News, with help from Joel Southern, I'm Emily Meehan.
Flags on the Navajo Nation in the Four Corners area will be flown at half staff, January 30th through February 2nd, in remembrance of the late U.S. Army Sergeant Clifton Yazzie, who was killed in Iraq last week. More than 250 family members and friends met on Tuesday night to remember the 23-year-old soldier who was nicknamed Tigger because of his upbeat attitude. Yazzie was serving his second tour of duty with the 101st Airborne Division when he and two other soldiers were struck by a roadside bomb on January 20th. Yazzie leaves behind a wife and two children, ages 3 and 18 months. A funeral service for Sergeant Yazzie will be held tomorrow at the Farmington Civic Center in Farmington, New Mexico. This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by Ridolfi Incorporated, using engineering and science to improve the quality of the environment for over 15 years. RIDOLFI.com. And by Amerind Risk Management Corporation, a Native venture protecting Indian country's assets. www.amerind-corp.org. Our theme music is provided by Jeff Silverman. Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.